Hello everybody and welcome to another Soul Eagle podcast. I'm joined today and I have the pleasure in introducing Dick Knight, who was the former chairman of Brighton Hove Albion and a former head of Albion in the community. A lifelong fan of Brighton Hove Albion, Dick took control in 1997, having led the fan pressure to oust the previous board following their sale of the club's Goldstone Grounds property developers, as everyone will remember. Dick remains a life president of Brighton Hove Albion and ex-chairman of the club's charitable wing Albion in the community. And as everyone knows who's probably been to the stadium, Dick's Bar is the pub at the ground which everyone goes to after and before the game. So thank you, Dick, for coming today and thanks for joining us. Really, I just read that introduction, but I've done a lot of research on you actually over the last couple of days, reading up on your colourful history. I found out that actually to start
not too with, colourful.
Not that colourful. But I found out, obviously, a lot of people know this and from the name of your autobiography, which will come on later as well, but you worked in advertising previously, and I didn't know this until I read this up, but you actually were behind the Hello Boys Wonder Bra advert.
Yeah, my agency, we did that campaign in the early 90s on a very small budget, but we had to make it, the woman was in charge of what was being said, you know, because up to then, advertising for bras was very sexist. And I wanted to change all that, and I wanted the woman to be in charge of the ad. So we did a lot of testing around, we had to have someone who was completely unknown to the public, you know, nice looking, but someone that was great in front of a camera. And we did these, we had offices all over Europe, and we did these photo shoot tests. And
amazing.
Came up with
life.
Six girls from different, from Prague, Warsaw, Milan, Moscow, and so on. And we had the final shoot test in my office in London. And it was amazing how many clients who wanted to come and have the meetings in our office
yeah,
that time.
Fair.
And of course the winner of that was Eva Herzegova from Prague. And she had a devilish smile. She was great. And she became, after that campaign, she became a supermodel. But it was that campaign that really brought her to the, you know, and it was very adventurous because the campaign, the women were in charge of the ad. They were saying, like, hello, boys, or she'd say goodbye to your feet, right? So it was always very, there was wit in it.
Yeah.
And it became a very famous campaign.
Yeah.
On a very small budget. But if you're adventurous in advertising, but also understand the mood of society, it didn't want to see, you know, advertising putting women down. It wanted to, you know, enable them to be in the ad on a firm basis, that they were actually in charge of the ad, so to speak. Mm. And she was a great, spokesperson for that.
Amazing advert. I remember it, actually. I was probably about 12 or 13 then.
No, well, it became one of the... It was voted in one advertising publicity awards in America, the greatest poster in the 20th century after Your Country Needs You.
Wow.
Which is from the First World War.
Mm.
Now, I wouldn't claim to be as good as that, but it was certainly very impactful because it put the woman in charge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was what we wanted to do, you know. So it was brave, but it was the sort of thing I used to do, you know.
So how did you start off in advertising? How did you get into advertising in the first
place?
Well,
I started off as a copywriter after I was did national service in the Air Force. My dad was in the Air Force in the Second World War. He managed to survive that. And he came back and took me to the Albion. One of the first things he did after the war was to take me to the Albion, to the Goldstone Ground. That was in 1946, because he was in the Far East initially. So he didn't get back till 46, when the war ended in 45. And one of the first things he did was take me to the Goldstone Ground. That was where my love affair with the Albion started.
Super.
But it was, and that is 75 years ago.
Amazing,
someone texted me yesterday saying, you know, this is the 75th anniversary of your supporting the Albion.
That's incredible.
Incredible, really.
That is, that's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Just going on to your advertising a little bit more, like in terms of working in advertising and sales, how would you say, we'll move on to your role at the club and how you got into the club, but how would you say this helped you in your time as chairman? What skill set would you say that added to you?
Well, you learn business. You know, I mean, if you set up, I started it in one of the top agencies, worked in New York a lot, which was very good grounding for a tough business scene. I came back to London and set up my own agency after five or six years working in big agencies. But one of the things I always did was to make sure that people enjoyed themselves, and I encouraged ideas and enthusiasm. The thing that people had to have a certain academic ability, because you're writing, you know, good grammar and so on. You have to be very literate. But at the end of the day, what really got to me was people who were enthusiastic. Because if someone is enthusiastic about their job, whatever it is, whether you're a lawyer, a footballer, or an advertising copywriter, if you're enthusiastic, that's half the battle. Because you can teach people on a crest of a wave, because they're willing to learn, they want to learn, because they're enthusiastic, you know. So that thread ran through. I mean, I started an ad agency in London with six people. When I left it, we employed 4,000 people.
Wow.
You know, worldwide, you know. So with various deals that I did with American agencies and a European agency, we grew, but the principle was always the same. Go for people that are, you know, bright, well-educated, but above, as much as anything, enthusiastic.
I completely
agree. They've got to have talent, obviously, but if they've got talent and enthusiasm, that's an unbeatable combination.
I completely agree. I think that's excellent advice for anyone, really, in any business or looking to get into any business. In terms of, obviously, you just told us that your first game was 75 years ago with your dad. That's amazing. And you've been a lifelong fan. But obviously, your involvement in the club developed over the years. How did the initial contact for you to get involved as a member of the board or to be part of anything, how did that come about?
Yeah, well, I never intended to become a director of the Albion, let alone the chairman of the Albion. But and I was too busy building my advertising empire because it became, you know, global sort of thing. But I would fly in on Saturday morning from wherever I'd been, New York, LA or Hong Kong. You know, I lived very near the Goldstone Ground. My family house is still there. So I would shower. I'd got off the plane, come home, shower, walk across Hove Park with my son and watched the Albion. And so it was great, you know, I was a fan and I never expected to be anything more than a fan. But what started happening in the early 90s, you know, people took over the club who were not really interested in the future of the club as a football club. They were more interested in the property value of the ground and so on. The asset value of the ground. And Liam Brady, who had, you know, the famous Arsenal footballer, had been the manager at the Albion, and he contacted me in early 1996, and he had resigned from being the manager of the club about a year earlier because he didn't like what they were doing. He refused to be part of it. So he resigned. And he approached me in fact, in 1995, but my wife, my first wife, had cancer. And sadly, she died at the end of that year. And when he first approached me, I was not in a position to do anything. He came back to me about 6 months later, sort of mid-96, and said, "Dick, you know, can you help? Because this club's going to go under. It really is." Because we were bottom of the league, of League Two, the lowest league. We didn't have a ground to play in. At the end of that season, we were going... The Goldston ground was going to be ripped up and a retail park built on it. And my predecessor had banked on getting planning permission for a huge retail park in Hove, in the Toadshall Valley, in that area, with a pretty small football ground in the corner, right? And he played off the two separate councils. At that time, Hove and Brighton were separate councils, so he played them off against each other and managed to, you know, get permission to sell the ground, the Goldstone ground, which is the club, you know, it had been the club's permanent home for nearly 100 years, but we were never going to make 100 years if I hadn't intervened, because he was prepared to, you know, we were going out of the league, we were bottom of the league, we had no ground to play at. He'd arranged a ground share at Gillingham, which is 75 miles from Brighton. It was the furthest ground share ever any club ever had in world football. No club ever played further away from its home, you know, its home matches that far away from its home. We had, you will understand this, every game that we played in London, every away game we played in London was nearer Brighton than our home games in Gillingham. It was incredible. And people used to say to me, you know, other clubs, I mean, it took me nearly 18 months to overthrow my predecessor because he was just clinging on, because he was hoping, you know, to get this planning permission for this retail park.
And that was Bill Archer in 1997. How difficult was that transaction? Was there anything memorable that you say
well,
you had to deal
the
with?
The memorable bit was that it lasted so long.
Right.
It took from April 1996 to... It started before April 1996, but the battle against him, you know, the fans were basically kind of... against what he was doing, and they had various protests, but it didn't have an edge to it because you need someone that could lead that and have the money to, you know, inject in and save the situation, which I had. But I immediately brought the fans on board with me because I stood up in front of them at various meetings in along the road from here in Hove Town Hall. In front of 2,000 people and said, "This is what I'm going to do, and you can ask me any questions you like about the Albion because I'll be able to answer all of them because I'm as much a fan as you are." And of course that endeared them to me because they knew I was a genuine fan, you know. There was a few fans who were actually older than me, but I because someone would I had them putting their hand up and they're asking questions saying how long they've been an Albion fan. Yeah. And they would say, "Oh, I saw my first game in, you know, 1972. And I would reply, "Get some time in." Because I saw my first game in April 1946. You know, but it was to get the fans on board and then use the resources of the fans. Some great, you know, intelligent people, determined people, use that.
Enthusiasm, as you said
well,
earlier.
Exactly. Love for, devotion for. I'm actually doing a podcast tomorrow for AFC Bury, which is the Phoenix club of the club that went bust last year. The people that are trying to revive that club want to, you know, talk to me about what I did at the Albion and how I revived the, you know, what was basically, it was more than ailing, it was, you know,
it was virtually gone.
Yeah. And the owner and the other directors didn't care. You know, they were interested in it. It was only basically two directors because he bought out all the others, Archer, by promising them that he would give them their money back. Well, so, you know, they got their money back and he got hold of all their shares.
Right. I mean, you famously said at the time that, you know, going to Gillingham and back was water for Duck's back. But do you think any club could survive something like that now, in terms of the commitment, the travel, the implications, both legal and, well, you know, logistically? I mean, obviously you said you're speaking to Bury tomorrow, but do you think clubs can survive this kind of issue now? Clubs have gone bust since Brighton, and you've...
Yeah, well, I think the current situation in the Football League, and I'm talking about the EFL as opposed to the Premier League,
yeah.
The Premier League doesn't have these problems because it's got so much money squirting around at the top of the game. The problem is that the money isn't going down to the lower levels in the way it should do, in a fair way. So I think, you know, the new season started last Saturday, and last season they started with, I'm talking about the EFL, they started with 72 clubs and they finished with 71 clubs because one, Bury, went bust. The big question for this season is they started again with 72 clubs. How many will they finish with? Because the pandemic has absolutely, it's a financial disaster for every level of the professional structure in this country, which is what the football, you know, the football pyramid in this country is part of the lifeblood of the country. It's part of the culture of the country. Because if you don't have the football pyramid, how could a club like Brighton go from the bottom of League Two, which is the fourth level, bottom of the fourth level, to the heights of the Premier League, which we're now in? That's because of the pyramid.
Yeah.
And the pyramid is now at risk. Because unless they can bail out the lower club, the government is not going to help EFL clubs because there's so much money in football at the top level.
What kind of obligation do you think the big clubs in the Premier League owe to the smaller clubs now? Because it's more of a moral obligation. There's no legal obligation.
Obligation. But if they want to... If the country wants to preserve football as we know it in this country, what it doesn't want is one elite league, which no one ever gets relegated out of it, which is what happens in America. You know, the NFL, the NBA, and the NHL, you know, the hockey league, all of those three leagues, and the MLS, you know, Major League Soccer, they all have a franchise system, which means you never get relegated. There's no level to go down to. So now Premier League clubs, and I'm speaking in my own personal view here, not on behalf of the Albion, they wouldn't mind that because that means they're never going to get relegated.
Absolutely.
But, you know, do we want that in this country? The answer is because of what football clubs mean to their communities all around the country. There's 72 in the league representing various communities, and I've demonstrated what football clubs can do within to help their communities, and a lot of other clubs have followed our lead on that. But we definitely led that back in the end of the night, you know, the end of the 20th century. You know, we developed a community model that was far-ranging and always used football as the linchpin to drive help for people, you know. So communities are vital as part of the football clubs in their communities play a huge role. Tony is a local guy here. We're lucky we've got a local... Brighton person. You know, two, me and then Tony, who succeeded me. Mm. That's unique in the Premier League because virtually all the clubs are owned by foreign people. And so they have an obligation, but they may have to be put under pressure about it from the government, you know, to meet their moral, it is a moral obligation.
I agree. I find it quite difficult to comprehend how in this transfer window, for example, Chelsea have spent over £200 million and we're living in the age of COVID-19 with people losing their jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
People getting sent on furlough. I do agree. I do think it's a moral obligation. In that sense, do you think that football could eventually become a German model where the fans have to own a certain percentage of the club? It seems to work in Germany. I mean, they've just won the Champions League by Munich.
Yeah, I think that it can do. But the alternative way of doing it is to have a person like me and Tony Bloom, who are genuine fans of the club, who are local people who love the club, from, you know, and have some money to be able to put in to revive the club. In my case, you know, to the tune of several million quid, but you know, Tony's taken it on to another level in terms of finance, but I think that the Premier League, you know, the country as a whole is going to be in such a deep economic hole that whatever we want to try and protect the institutions in our society, one of which is football. It's part of the culture of the country. So, you know, in order to maintain that, the Premier League are going to have to spread their money more fairly across the lower leagues, including even below the Football League. There's seven levels in the pyramid. And, you know, the Football League covers levels 2, 3, 4. But then there's three levels below that, which are, you know, what they call the National League, the conference. Mm. And then there's one level below that. That is the football pyramid, if you like. And I think that, you know, the money has got to be spread more fairly. But that is my personal opinion.
Oh, I agree.
Because you know, I can't speak for Tony on that because he's the chairman of a Premier League club. And I'm the life president of a Premier League club. But having said that, I know where we came from. And a lot of our fans know where we came from. And if there wasn't that pyramid, we could never have got to the Premier League.
Yeah, clubs are nothing without their community and their fans. Mm. So, you know, clubs are nothing without their community and their fans.
The pyramid is vital to enable a club like Brighton to go from the, you know, virtually League 5, which we're almost in, the last game of the season, that season, 1997, where we had to get a point at Hereford, which we managed to do. That was the second. I took over as chairman the last ever game at the Goulston Ground. I mean, how crazy is that?
Yeah.
You know, no ground to go to. People dismantling the ground, taking home souvenirs. It was just incredible.
Moving on to the ground issues. I mean, you were obviously chairman for the Nomad years, where obviously 10 years, was it, trying to get a ground? I've got a few facts here.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to give a bit of a background for people if they don't know. The original planning application was submitted back in 2000. And despite overwhelming majority of the local community being in favour, Lewes District Council, mainly due to its proximity to an area of outstanding natural beauty, if anyone knows where the stadium is, they'll know obviously the views are outstanding, they obviously opposed that. In 2005, the Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott granted a club planning permission. However, the decision letter referred to the site being built in a built-up area of Brighton and Hove, but actually it crossed over into Lewes. How did you feel when they came
back
into that letter?
Well, the battle to, you know, we, you know, the day I took over as chairman of the club in April 1997, well, formally I became chair in September 1997, but I was looking for a new ground then, you know, obviously, because Gillingham was no solution at all. We went through in that, we got local planning permission in 2002, you know, after a lot of battling, to prove to the local council that this was a viable project and that literally hundreds of thousands of people were in favour of it.
Mm.
You know, but what happened, we got called, it got called in for a public inquiry. And there were two public inquiries. The first one, despite the fact we were very confident at the end of this public inquiry, which took about 6 weeks, you know, the public inquiry is not something that's done in a day. Nevertheless, we are ruling that the inspector turned it down. But because we had an inkling that was going to happen, literally about 3 weeks earlier, that he was going to turn it down, we went full blast in publicity to get, I mean, what we did in that very short, a few weeks, we mailed every football club in the country. We sent them flowers and said, you know, please help us. We sent a Valentine, we took a Valentine's card to John Prescott's, a huge Valentine's card, as big as this wall there, you know, to delivered it to his constituency office in Hull to say, you know, please, can we have our a stadium? Anyway, so what happened, Prescott, as the minister in charge, normally when a public inquiry inspector recommends something, 99 times out of 100, the minister just rubber stamps the recommendation. But Prescott didn't, and I'll never hear a bad word against him, because he had the guts to overrule his expert, so-called expert, because he told me after, this is right after everything, because he couldn't say it, that he said I was being basically not told all the facts by my civil servants. There was obviously someone in the civil service who was very keen for us not to have a stadium at Fowler. You know,
amazing.
Yeah, so basically, he did, despite the recommendation, he called another public inquiry, and then a different inspector did that, and after that, he recommended it, the second inspector. So Prescott gave it, and that was 2005, but then it went another 2 years because of what you just said.
The letter.
The letter saying it was all in Brighton, and it wasn't. A small part of it was in Lewes.
Now, interestingly, obviously, as you know, Dick, we're a law firm, so I need to ask you, did you, at this point, did your lawyers get involved, did your solicitors
They were involved all the way through.
But in specifically, I mean, about this, I guess it's an error in the decision letter in the terminology and the placement of the stadium. At that point, did you challenge the letter? Did you try and get your fees back at least? I mean, there's a huge amount of fees when it comes to planning.
No, you know, what we had to do was, you know, they took it to the High Court, Lewes Council, without the approval of their residents. And we obviously challenged it because the significance of this error, which is on page 28 of this letter, was nowhere near as important as they made out. It was just virtually a typing error.
Yeah.
It was absolutely disgraceful.
Yeah, and I mean, for Lewes District Council, that would have cost them a huge amount in legal fees.
It cost us another £2 million.
Wow.
Because of that, Lewes appealing it and taking it to the High Court.
And did you never consider actually claiming those fees against the obviously not the Secretary of State's office for
no, because he'd then been replaced by someone else who is
Hazel Blears.
Yeah, the letter eventually came from her, but she was never, I mean, she based, John Prescott had put her straight about, you know, this football club should have this stadium. And it's been, I was misinformed initially. He actually said to me, this is after everything had been resolved, because he was regularly in contact with me, but he would never say what he was never going to give me his personal opinion, because he couldn't. Mm. He had to be completely impartial, which he was. But when he saw the evidence, you know, petitions. Yeah, we had 109,000 people, one of the petitions. Brighton never played in front of that number of people, obviously. And it's virtually half the population of Brighton Hope. Yeah. But it was the numbers were incredible. Mm. And he had never been told this.
Right.
I never put that in my book.
No.
You know, because it was, I didn't want to put him in a difficult position, except that he had the courage to go against what his minister, what his inspector recommended.
You wonder if politicians would have that kind of courage now.
Well, they wouldn't. And John Prescott had the balls to actually go against the recommendation.
Yeah.
Because as far as he was concerned, he'd been fed. He was only fed some of the information, not all of it. And that's what he worked out himself, you know. And a good old job is what I say.
Well, my memory of him is obviously working class background, as you said, from Hull. He gave the guy a lamping for throwing an egg at him that day. So yeah. Just a normal person doing
that. Yeah, he is, I think he's still alive, isn't he?
Yeah.
But he's a real man of the people.
Yeah.
And, he did well in politics. He got to be he was deputy prime minister when he was also Minister of Media, Culture and Sport.
Well, I mean, obviously without him there wouldn't be a ground, so he's done exactly. A tremendous job for Brighton.
Yeah, we wouldn't have a ground if it wasn't for John.
Hello, you lovely people. Just to note that this is a podcast and does not constitute legal advice. Should you require any specific legal advice based on anything, then please contact your solicitor, or even better, us, and we can advise you fully.